Hello, my name is John Sifferman, and you're in for a real treat because with me on the phone today is Ryan Murdoch, who is a travel writer and is also on the faculty coaching staff of RMAX International, where he teaches the circular strength training system. I wanted to interview Ryan today because he has a very unique perspective on health and fitness and has a seemingly natural ability of staying in excellent health, even with an uncommonly hectic lifestyle. As one of the editors of Outpost magazine, Ryan is often called to obscure places in the world where he must brave some of the harshest living and travel conditions. It is in these situations that he puts his physical and mental conditioning to the ultimate test, and no doubt brings back some insights about how to live in strength and health, even under the worst circumstances. Ryan is also the creator of the RMAX Powered Bujinkan DVD series and co-author of the best-selling ebook Bodyweight Exercise Revolution. So it's my pleasure to introduce Ryan Murdoch. Welcome to the call, Ryan.
All right, thanks, John. I don't know how I can live up to that that intro, but we'll see what we can do.
Well, we'll just have a fun little interview here. Could you just tell us a little about yourself for those who don't know you already?
Sure, yeah. As you said, I'm a faculty coach for RMAX International, so this means I'd end up doing things like coaching certification seminars, instructor certifications in CST. Doing media stuff for RMAX. We create new expressions of the system, so we're kind of the research and development team at RMAX, and we're constantly pushing the boundaries of CST. But not just that, we're also tasked with improving the way we communicate the system. So if you've been around for a while, you've noticed over the years that we've revamped the certification process and how we deliver the courses. And that's an important part of our work because CST is a path of personal mastery. We need to find a way to communicate this stuff and get people on that path in the most direct way possible without sidetracks. So that's a big part of it. The other work that I do, we're focused on instructor development quite a lot. So I spend a lot of time working with our instructors and coaches and head coaches to make them into not just better coaches but better athletes in their own right. As faculty, we also bridge the gap between the coaching side and the corporate side of RMAX. So we're involved on a daily basis in plotting a business strategy for the spread of CST throughout the world. So there's all that on the faculty side. And as you mentioned, I'm the senior editor of RMAX magazine, which has quite a large global audience. I think it's the largest health and fitness site online right now. And I'm a faculty director for Europe and Canada.
Fantastic. Now, what caused you to get involved with the health and fitness industry? And can you give us the full spectrum of what your physical training involved prior to finding CST?
Your first question, to be honest, as far as the industry goes, I needed a portable occupation. At the time, I was working some god-awful temp jobs in an effort to support my writing, and writing and publishing takes a long time to break into, so I was looking for something that, some sort of work that I could do that was more satisfying than office jobs for the Canadian government, and something I could take on the road with me. I had been teaching martial arts for about a decade and a half, I guess, and had been dissecting Coach Sonnen's stuff from the very first Grappler's Toolbox video, so I had years of experience with his stuff, and we picked apart absolutely everything that he ever released on the mats and tested it in every variation possible. So I was already quite convinced that his stuff was the real thing, that he was really onto something. But at the same time, I was sick to death of teaching, and I decided I would never teach again. So especially martial art, I just kind of burned out on it. So I got involved in the organization quite reluctantly. My training partner at the time, from the old Ninjutsu days, a guy called Rick Merritt convinced me that I would be good at it, and that I would have something to offer the organization, and that I could possibly work my way up through the ranks and really do something with it. So he kind of convinced me, and I attended my first certification seminar at kind of against my own will. I'm not really as much of a seminar guy, but actually it turned out to be a great experience. And then Coach Sonnen asked me to join his faculty. Less than a year later, I think. So, again, I was quite reluctant to take that step. For one, I really didn't think I had anything to offer. at that level, I mean, I figured it was way above anything I could contribute. And compared to guys like Coach Jones and Coach Wilson on the faculty, who have much broader backgrounds than me, I really didn't know what he had in mind. But as any good athlete, he's my coach, and I shut up and did what I was told, and it seems that it worked out all right in the end. So yeah, that's more or less how I got involved in the fitness industry, reluctantly and kind of kicking and screaming. But it's been a pretty cool ride.
That's awesome. Now, I understand you were inducted into Martial Arts Hall of Fame in 2006, and that you are a high-ranking practitioner of Bujinkan Budo Taijutsu. How does your study of martial art impact your views on health and fitness?
Well, it's for me, martial art shapes absolutely everything. It's shaped my entire approach to health and fitness. I mean, in the early days before I worked on Scott's material, like you had asked what kind of training I'd done in the past before this. That was all fueled by martial arts. I mean, we're always my old training partner Rick and I were always trying to find some kind of performance edge. Anything that would make we knew conditioning was important, but in the world of traditional martial arts, it was never emphasized. Well, people were quite often fat and weak, to be honest, and they felt technique was somehow superior. All you needed was perfect technique, and conditioning didn't matter. But our own experience had taught us that wasn't true. So we scoured everything we could find. I mean, I did all the usual bodybuilding stuff, which didn't do a thing for my performance on the mats. We went through absolutely everything we could find about traditional martial art conditioning methods and tried all that. So out in the woods, ripping bark off of trees with your hands and hitting rocks and stuff, all the idiotic stuff I guess everybody does when they're younger. There was a phase where they started to publish some of Bruce Lee's old journals, so we picked those apart, looked at what he was trying to do. We built some of the same crazy contraptions that he had made and worked with all this. For a while, there was an evolutionary fitness approach that was quite popular. We worked with that. Pavel's stuff, way before RKC, when it was Power to the People, so all the deadlifting and the overhead presses, which actually hurt my martial art performance and caused me to injure myself quite a few times before I finally realized that wasn't really the path I needed to be on, and that led us to Scott stuff. So all my explorations in health and fitness were shaped by martial arts for sure, and it's that search for the ultimate edge and being ruthlessly practical with it. There's no time for wishful thinking. I mean, if it doesn't work, you're going to find out that it doesn't work in the mats, and you have to be willing to pressure test everything, all your great theories. And when they fail, to step back and reinvent the wheel all over again, even if it means throwing away a year's worth of work maybe, which we did many times. So I think that sort of that kind of hard martial art edge really, really fuels my approach in absolutely everything that I do. And it's true on the travel side as well. I mean, it's universal.
Absolutely. Now, I know you've been to some very obscure areas of the world. Has your training come in handy in any of your expeditions? I mean, no doubt for personal development reasons, obviously, but like you said, for practical reasons.
Having to fight my way out of places, you mean?
What's that?
Having to fight my way out of places?
Well, just, you know, having the mentality of being able to avoid confrontation from the first place. Mm. But, then, I mean, if something
ever
did...
physical altercations are always going to happen. They have in the past. But when you're alone in a place and you don't speak the language, you're perceived as easy prey. I mean, you're a visible minority moving through this place. Some of those countries are kind of rough. And I found that martial art thinking was absolutely essential to me. I mean, the ability to switch it on. If you've read any of the work of a guy like Gavin De Becker, for example, he talks about the stages of conflict and how the assailant will first size you up and see if you're whether or not you're a victim type, whether you'll be an easy target. And there's what he calls an interview stage, where they'll throw something out at you, maybe physically or verbally. And if you fail the stage and react weakly, it'll progress to the next stage of the altercation and spiral on downwards from there. So that kind of martial art background, I think, really helps you to diffuse situations in the interview stage way more often than not. I mean, to be able to switch it on and reveal that there is some fight in you, can shut it down. But also, and that can only come from serious preparation. I mean, you can't bullshit that if especially in those kind of places. I mean, somebody's going to call your bluff, and when they do, it's usually quite serious for you. So if you don't have that foundation of serious hard training, you can't get away with bluffing that there is some fight in you when there's not. I mean, my first big trip was to Central America, which at the time was still fairly rough. I don't think it's as well. They just had a coup in Honduras, so I guess maybe it's still a bit unstable. But at the time, you know, I went down there by myself. I had no idea what I was getting into, and I didn't speak the language or anything like that. But my preparation for the trip involved a lot of knife drills, for example. I mean, I was carrying a small clip knife with me down there, so I practiced pulling that knife out with either hand from any different number of combinations and environmental situations, and a lot of practice in front of the mirror, for example, drawing the knife from angles that you couldn't see it coming out, so it would just be revealed sort of at the end of my reach, which progressed to live cutting drills where I somehow convinced my friend to wrap his arm in pieces of phone book and come at me with a machete, so we would cut up I would hack up his arm, you know, with the phone books on his arm, with the knife that I was actually carrying, because training with machetes too, because everybody down there seems to carry them, and drunken machete fights really do happen. I know, as dumb as that sounds. Training with a belt, for example, is a flexible weapon. We dug up old European strategy manuals on cloak and dagger, so using like a jacket wrapped around your arm, kind of dangling a bit to maybe absorb cuts and hide your knife behind. Or actually, there was another really cool thing in my Bujinkan days called Yoroi Kumiichi, which dealt with fighting in that big old samurai armor. Like if you saw those movements just without the armor, just done freely, it looked really slow and cumbersome, big ponderous movements and slow strikes. But when you're encumbered with a lot of weight, actually it made sense. So I would practice with a heavy backpack on, you know, for the times when I'd have to move between towns or whatever, and you're sort of vulnerable when you've got all this weight on you. So practice absorbing blows with the bag, for example, and then using the weight of that in the same way they would use the fighting in armor, using the weight of the backpack to add a bit of sting to my punches or some gravity to your throws. So, I mean, that all that kind of stuff comes into play, and that's what fuels the ability to defeat these kind of sizing up sort of situations in the interview stage, so you don't have to fight, but you've got to have that ability to fight when it comes down to it, because every once in a while it will. But not just that, though. I mean, that's just the basic martial art thing, but for me the ninjutsu background was really crucial, because I feel it gave me the ability to blend in to some of these places. I mean, not when you're the only white guy in Asia or something. It's not, I don't mean blend in like that, but to sort of move, to know when to play naive and drift through a scene as though you're sort of bumbling and harmless, and play stupid to get yourself through, which works an awful lot of the time, or to know when to switch it on and show that you can fight if you have to. But I mean, overall, it's important, because it's a way of seeing the world, and it taught me to see situations strategically, and I think it made me a very careful observer of situations, dynamics, interactions, and body language, and I think that's probably influenced my writing as well. So yeah, martial arts has shaped everything for me, and including travel, and it saved my ass in a lot of places as well.
Uh-huh. Well, very, very cool. All right, let's talk about CST a little bit.
Sure.
Could we talk about joint mobility training and why it's important, especially for people who are on the road or on the job a lot?
Yeah, joint mobility, moving your body through, or moving all your joints through their full healthy range of motion each day is essential to lubricate the joints, to ensure joint health, to get this nutrition to the places where it's needed, and to remove the waste products of exercise. It's absolutely crucial in all these things, and for me it's kind of my daily minimum. So it's if I can do nothing else, that's what I do. I've got all the usual stories that everybody seems to have of watching old injuries kind of reverse themselves until they vanish. I mean, everybody who's trained martial arts seriously is a laundry list of injuries usually. And And this drum mobility practice seems quite magical in taking that away. But the other, well, and I also notice, I mean, like, I actually feel bad now if I don't do it each day. Not because you somehow become addicted to it, but because I think most of the time we carry around such massive amounts of tension that we don't even know it's there. I mean, that sort of background static or noise of tension that's constantly buzzing through us becomes your baseline, and you forget that it's there. So once you remove it, like once you shut off that static charged radio or whatever, and you experience silence all of a sudden, you notice when something impinges on it. So you sort of get better at noticing when something's going wrong before it gets worse and turns to a larger problem. And the other cool thing about the jump mobility, and especially Interflow, is that it seems to accelerate the rate at which you assimilate new skills. I think that's really cool. Because you, like a dancer who has to learn to isolate down very particular movements, you learn how to have greater control over your body in small ways. And as a coach, you're watching the athletes that you're training and helping them to recover that, so you get much better at noticing small movements in others as well. So I think it improves your lens. It gives you a better sense of which movements are important when you're trying to assimilate new skills. You see them much more clearly. The root ingredients of mastery, I guess, in those movements, and then you're able to replicate them much faster yourself. So that's been absolutely amazing for me, I think. And on the road, of course, that's my daily minimum, no matter where I go. Sitting in planes all the time and traveling around a lot, it's you get all kinked up. I mean, air travel gets worse and worse, and the seats get smaller, and I'm quite tall as well, so that's always an exercise in misery, you know, unless you're flying business class, which, yeah, hats off to you. I wish I could. But, yeah, that's important as a restorative when you're on the road. And I personally need to do a lot of stuff like pigeon holds, for example, from Prasara, or the seated half twist, because my problem areas end up being tight glutes, tight piriformis from sitting on planes and stuff like that all the time. So anything to release that is essential. I mean, that's... I do that a lot if I'm on the road.
Fantastic. Now, what kind of strength training tools do you use personally and recommend to others? I'm sure this is, you know, unique to whether you're at home or on travel.
For me, the club bell primarily. I mean, that's out of everything I've ever used in my entire history of training, that's given me by far the best results, and it's the most fun I've ever had training as well. But I know that sounds like the party line, but that's my honest opinion. I do use other tools, but I mean, I could quite happily ditch everything and only train with club bells for the rest of my days, and I think I'd be quite happy. But in addition to that, I use kettlebells. I'm certified under Valery Fedorenko to instruct kettlebells, but I don't practice kettlebell sports at all. Things like parallettes, rings, pull-up bar, med ball, plyo box, all that kind of stuff, like mainly in a tack fit style circuit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I'm sure body weight training specifically has served you well as a method due to its minimalist nature. Would you explain how you use body weight training while traveling or while at home?
Sure, yeah. Body weight training is, especially the CST body weight training, is really cool because it gives you so many options. I mean, it's totally portable. It's minimalist, you don't need much space, and you carry around everything you need in your own head, so you don't have to deal with expensive gym memberships or other people's schedules, which really I hate having to do. But so at home, yeah, I cycle it in and out depending on what I'm working on at the time. Often it's blended into other work, such as with a tack fit circuit. And there might be some body weight movements combined with maybe some club bell stuff or other pieces of equipment. Or I might use like a body flow type thing from CST to rewire a movement pattern or to release an area of tension. But it's on the road where I really hit the body weight stuff a lot more. Like if I'm on a trip where I'm in hotel rooms all the time, of course the Interflow is the daily minimum, but I'll maybe work a session of flow fit that day or a Metcon style circuit depending on what I'm working on. If I just want to maintain an adequate level of health and kind of work the kinks out, flow fit works really well for that. Or if I want something more intense and I'm trying to keep a training edge, for example, if I'm coaching a seminar while I'm on the road, I'll work something more Metcon style. And then when it comes to an expedition, for example, it's normally just Prasara and into flow. Because like an expedition type thing is the on season for me, if you're spinning it into sports terms. So I mean, that's when you're actually in the field doing the stuff, that's the time to focus on removing restrictive forces and releasing the parking brake from your performance at the end of each day. You don't want to add driving forces. I mean, you've already got all the gains you're going to get in your off season, sort of in the lead up to the trip, in the prep. When you're in the field, the last thing you need to do is add more work. It's usually more a case of removing tension that you put in so that you're able to get up and do it all again the next morning, and that you can kind of keep off that creeping tension as much as possible until the job's done. So yeah, it tends to vary depending on the sort of trip. But there's a vast amount of stuff to choose from with CST, so it works out really well.
Okay. Now, you've already half answered my next question. Now, I've heard that you've traveled by dugout canoe, camel, and motorcycle. Now, I'm sure some of those modes...
Much more, too. You're missing some there. There's Russian jeep. what else? Riverboat. Coastal freighter, really rusty ones. Horses, which I try to avoid because I got a really bony ass, and this horse is not kind to me at all. And, on foot by helicopter, and in some really dodgy airplanes. That probably rounds out the list.
Okay,
sorry, yeah. I didn't mean to cut you off there. But
so all of those modes of transportation, I'm sure they do some wonderful things to your body over a period of days and weeks. You mentioned Prasara before. How does Prasara specifically come in handy? I mean, Prasara is a real deep tension release, but how would you use it? I mean, is it just an end-of-the-day thing or throughout the day or what?
It depends on when you have time. I mean, I'll throw in some joint mobility during the day. I mean, if you're pounding across Mongolia in a Russian jeep, it's quite uncomfortable and you're hitting your head on the ceiling all the time and on the metal bar that they place behind the seat for whatever reason to keep you awake, I guess, but... Whenever you take a break and jump out, that's a great time to whip out some joint mobility, kind of feel around, see where the kinks are. You don't usually have time to drop into any sort of deep yoga, but I generally do that at night, sitting around the campfire. You know, once it gets too dark out to write, then that's a great chance to unwind and loosen off some tension. And actually, some of the Prasara stuff is excellent prep as well. I mean, the shin box, for example, that's great prep for riding camels. Specifically dromedary camels rather than Bactrian, but that's great carryover. So I would even prep with that.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Because if you think about it, if you've seen the Arabian camels, you the position of sitting on top of one is very similar to a shin box. You've got that one leg hooked around the front of the saddle, which is kind of where the hump is on the camel. And then the other leg doesn't sit back in a shin box, but it kind of drops straight down. But you need to use that for stability and kind of pressing in on the front of the animal to keep yourself upright, and then that spinal mobility that you develop in the shin box position allows you to maintain your balance, because, I mean, you're not in stirrups or anything. There's nothing holding you on there at the top except your own balance. So when you start to gallop across the desert or something, then mobility and comfort in that position is essential, especially when you're sitting like that all day. So, yeah, that's CST is tailor-made for you. I'm going to do an ebook on that sometime, preparation for specifically dromedary camel expeditions.
That's fantastic. I'm sure there's a really big market for that.
Well, the Bedouin, if somebody could teach the Bedouin to read, I think they'd be interested.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right, now we've talked about training. Could you give us a big picture perspective on what your total training program looks like? How do the three wings of CST work together in your fitness program?
Yeah, that's a good question. The three wings are integrated daily. I mean, it's in every session. Every session starts with joint mobility. I might do joint mobility in the morning. I hate to train in the morning, to be honest, but after I've woken up, I'll do my joint mobility, a deep and full session early in the day, but I always prime before work with specific joint mobility. So it moves from joint mobility, priming the joints and getting everything prepared for work, to the work phase, which could be club bell training or a tack fit circuit or a heavy body weight circuit. And then finally, once you're nice and hot and sweaty with all that, to warm down with Prasara and specifically remove the tension and compensate for the work you just did. So the Prasara I'm actually spending more time on the Prosara phase these days, not just compensating for the work of the circuit, but compensating for all your other issues that everybody has and that you're constantly sort of chasing to their source. Everybody's got the history of whatever injuries or discomforts. I mean, nobody's a clean slate, so there's always a lot of things like that to work on. But so in the macro, the three wings, or in the micro, the three wings come into play in every single session. It's always balanced. In the bigger picture, my personal training varies depending on my seminar and product development these days. I'm usually either training up for a seminar, in which case I'll work through the material that we'll be presenting and that we're coaching to our prospective instructors, or I might be training up for a product shoot or something, like a photos for an ebook or video clips. Or the other thing is experimenting to develop new ideas. So it could be an R&D phase where we're training a new method of periodization or something for CST. And in between any of that stuff, any chance I get, I'm going back to the basics. So always hammering the basics. That's just like martial art in that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit more about your travel and how how you can draw some insights about, you know, physical living. So with the unique challenges of travel, do you find that you need a specific kind of fitness that may be different from, you know, what the normal definition is, if there was a normal definition?
It always depends on the type of trip. I mean, if it's a work thing, like a magazine assignment or something, it's there's obviously specific prep involved in something like a hiking expedition, for example. There will always be specific demands of that type, or compared to a camel expedition or something like this. You've got to analyze the specific demands of those particular trips and try to prepare for that. But that being said, that SPP platform's on a base of three-dimensional functional fitness. That's so the GPP base that sits under that is broad-based and very functional. And in my experience, the TACFIT is about the best I've ever found, the TACFIT program developed by Coach Sonnen, because the demands are varied on one of these trips. Like, you could be loading up a Jeep with heavy supplies at one minute, you know, trying to wrestle these containers into awkward positions in the back of a Jeep, and the next minute you might be wrestling a stubborn camel to the ground, so you've had to jump up and get this beast around the neck and sweep its legs out and get it down. That requires a great deal of functional fitness if you're to avoid being bitten, I guess. And that, so TACFIT's great for that in the array of tools that it combines, in the full sort of full range three-dimensional strength it builds. But also what I find cool about TACFIT is, unlike anything else I've come across, it works on compressing the recovery time between bursts of effort. So if you can burst quicker more often, but you get your heart rate and pulse rate and everything else under control quickly, right after that, you can access fine motor skills even in crisis moments, which is key if you're dangling at the end of a rope or something and you've got one chance to grab a hold. You want to get that arousal level down pretty quickly. Or if you got to make a very sensitive shot and you just finished sprinting someplace, you need to get a handle on yourself really fast, and there may not be time to waste depending on the situation. So it's important to have access to something that will help you reassimilate that. And that's where the reset protocol as well comes in very handy. I mean, to master something like that is tremendously useful in the field, I find.
Mm-hmm.
So it's functional fitness, but it's tactical fitness as well.
Okay. Now, what type of insights have you drawn about physical living when visiting more obscure areas of the world?
Yeah, that's a tough one to answer. I mean, I don't know in terms of physical living, but in terms of living in general, I mean, there's a pile of stuff. One of the things that becomes quite obvious to you, I think, is that there's more than one right way to live, and that ours isn't necessarily the best way. That's something that hits home when you go to a place like, I don't know, the Darien Gap in Panama, for example, where I hung out with some Mbari Indians there that way up this jungle river. I mean, the kids had never seen white people even. It was quite a remote place, and their way of life was very much in harmony with the environment that they lived in. They didn't have a lot of possessions. I mean, everything was shared quite communally in the village, and they they took from the forest only what they needed. There was no concept of this mass consumerism and accumulating things. So a way of life such as the one we push on everybody from the West would devastate a place like that quite quickly. So the idea that progress is everything in a place like that is maybe misguided. Our view of progress isn't always the same view of progress that other people hold. So that's one big lesson. I think another big one for me was learning how little you need to be happy and to live a fulfilling life. Because if you're bumming around for a while and everything, absolutely everything you own is you're carrying with you, you quickly realize how much shit you accumulate back home and how little of that you really need and how it just weighs you down like an anchor. And you quickly come to appreciate that there's very little, if anything, you need. And some of the happiest times I've ever spent were just sitting on some little island in the middle of nowhere. We had next to nothing at all, but what we had was quite enough. And I think you become more satisfied with your day-to-day life after an experience like that. But I think in terms of insights about living, the biggest lesson for me probably in all these things that really hit home was on the first trip I took to Central America, and that trip taught me about my possibilities. I think it was the first time I could see myself without boxes, if that makes sense. Good way to phrase that. We know about ourselves from our interactions with other people. Other people become kind of our social mirrors, and we learn about ourselves based on how they reflect back to us what we think we are. And for me, I mean, I came from a very small town where everybody knows everything about you and your entire history, and your place in that setting is very firmly established. I mean, the stronger are doomed to perpetual strength and the weaker are condemned to perpetual weakness kind of thing. It's very hard to change anything in a place like that, because when you try to change yourself or when you try to do something that's not you, you push up against those boxes and other people push back. I mean, yes, your friends and family have your best interest at heart in theory, but they really don't want you to change deep down, because when you change, that threatens the worldview, or that threatens the sort of you that exists in their mind, and they've got to reshuffle their categories to deal with this new changing person. And we're, of course, programmed to embrace inertia, so it's uncomfortable for people to change their mental concepts. So I found that by going to a place like Central America where I didn't know anybody, and nobody knew me, nobody knew my past or the person I was supposed to be, I got a very different impression back from those people than I would have back home, for example. And I kind of got a glimpse of myself without all those boxes. And it really surprised me. I mean, I had to kind of accept that everything I'd ever maybe thought about myself could have been false. And it sort of totally rearranged my worldview. I mean, I realized that I could become much more than I was, and that there wasn't any limit. I mean, I didn't have to be limited by any of these things. So it was a big dose of personal freedom and a huge slap in the face, I think, realizing what really exists and what's out there and how much you really can accomplish. But at the same time, it's very difficult to take such a realization and bring it back and drop back into that setting where you'd come from. I think you have to also accept that you'll never really fit in there again. So that's that kind of knowledge always comes with a price, I think. At least that's what I found. That's the two-minute philosophy, everything I've learned on the road, more or less.
Great. We should probably get it out in bullet points. But
hey, there's a book coming. Don't worry about it.
But seriously, I think that those are three things that everyone should, really think about deeply and how it applies to them and, on a very...
And the thing is, you've got to come to your own appreciation of those lessons. I mean, you have to... throw yourself out there and any path, it doesn't have to be travel, it could be anything. Any path that you embrace deeply should challenge you with those kind of things, and it's up to you to face those challenges. That's the thing, you can't hide from it.
Exactly. All right, well, have you noticed any common themes in health among more indigenous people that have minimal contact with the quote-unquote modern world?
Yeah, you see this a lot in books on diet and nutrition. For example, what the hell's the name? Oh, the metabolic typing diet. There, I'm looking at my bookshelf. That's a great example of they talk about how when people eat according to their type or their genetic type or the place that they came from, their health is much better. And I found that to be true generally. I mean, for example, with the Embera, again, for example, in the Darien, a place with very little contact with outside, the kids were very healthy. I mean, they nice straight white teeth, good skin, good posture. They seemed to be in excellent physical health. But at the same time, places like that are also plagued by diseases like malaria. So it's there are some downsides. I mean, it isn't an Eden or some ideal state that we can go back to. There are things that modern technology can help. Like, for example, Mongolia, they've still got the bubonic plague, which I found quite startling. I mean, that's the Black Death that wiped out most of Europe in the Middle Ages. I mean, that still exists, and it's when I was bumming around Mongolia in 2002, there was a plague outbreak in the South Gobi, and they quarantined a big part of the desert when I was in there, and I always thought that'd be kind of interesting to get the plague because there's medicine for it now, and I mean it's curable. It should be eradicated, but it's not. But I thought it'd be kind of a cool conversation piece to have, you know, been afflicted with the bubonic plague at some point. But I figured it's not a good risk out there because getting medicine to the middle of Mongolia is kind of hit or miss at best. So there's that general good health among indigenous peoples that are uncontacted by the West largely. But there are also endemic diseases that tend to ravage those populations. They're quite helpless to do much about. But the most glaring thing I've seen, I think, is the reverse of that, where traditional cultures have come into extensive contact with the West and with increasing wealth, and you immediately see a skyrocketing in obesity and lifestyle diseases, the kind of lifestyle diseases that we're plagued with, the self-induced problems like hypertension. I mean, you don't see diabetes in these traditional places or obesity on that scale or things like carpal tunnel syndrome. I never saw that, but one place that really stood out was Thailand, for example, fairly westernized and quite wealthy compared to other countries in the region. Across the border there, and you've got paved roads and 7-Elevens and a very nice quality of life, but also some really, really fat people compared to, say, next door Burma or Myanmar, I guess they call it now, a country that's been cut off by their dictatorial government, where I found that people were in wonderful health. Everybody had sort of a healthy body weight and nice smiles, except for that god awful betel nut habit. Which are you familiar with betel nut at all?
No.
Oh, it's this horrible shit that they chew. It's a nut from a betel tree, I guess, but they wrap it in a leaf of some kind and then put a bunch of lime in it. Not the fruit lime, but the mineral lime. And then shove that in their yap, and you spit this massive gouts of red juice everywhere, which is kind of cool, actually, because it tastes very foul, but it's some kind of a mild stimulant, like a cup of coffee or something. But
yeah.
But if you're chewing betel nut, you can spit wherever you want. So I enjoyed that. I mean, just the freedom to just cork a huge line of massive amounts of spit all over the place, and people wouldn't give you a second look. But the problem with betel nut, it makes their teeth go all red, and then it kind of rots your teeth out. So all these betel nut chewers have perpetually kind of reddened teeth and rotten grills. So, you know, apart from, with the exception of betel nut chewing, I found that a place like Burma to be much more healthy than a place that was heavily westernized and quite wealthy, like Thailand, for example. So we're exporting our lifestyle diseases at the same time as we're exporting helpful things like medicine for malaria, for example. So yeah,
right.
It's a bit of a conundrum. I mean, how do you can't halt progress, but at the same time, it's very sad to watch these people lose their culture and give up so much for all the shit that Hollywood pushes and all these glamorized Western images. And then once they get that and they've lost their culture, they realize how empty it is, the things that they've embraced, and they wish they could get it back, but it's too late. Yeah, you see that a lot.
Okay.
Well, in your personal manifesto on your website, you say, quote, "I believe that mastery of body can lead to mastery of and mind can lead to mastery of life, but you must be prepared to go beyond that." Could you explain what that means?
Yeah. To go beyond means go beyond everything. I mean, go beyond what you perceive as your limitations and your weaknesses. I mean, you have to. You can't hide from those things, but you've got to seek them out and confront them. You've got to go beyond gaps in your knowledge, for example. You can't be content not to know. I mean, it's fine not to know stuff, but I don't know how anybody could rest comfortably once they realize they don't know stuff. So you've got to go beyond things like that, go beyond geographically into unknown territory off the map, beyond the preconceived, I think. Go beyond the limitations and worldviews of your culture. And maybe even the system of morality that you were raised with. And you're recognizing, the first step, I think, is recognizing that there is something to go beyond in the first place. So never being content and always daring for greatness in whatever small way and in everything that you do. And I think that can begin with mastery of the body, with martial art or CST or any practice. I mean, the Japanese martial arts master has always had that saying, to master one thing, master one thing is to master 10,000 things. So the principles of stepping on that path of mastery, it doesn't really matter what your gateway into it is, but you must always be prepared to venture into the unknown and to grow. And growing involves pushing all of those boundaries and never being content to rest where you are right now. Yeah, that's what it means to me, I think.
Okay. Just a couple more questions. Where could our listeners find more information about you and your work specifically?
I've got two websites, RyanMurdock.com, www.RyanMurdock.com is my writing site, so that's all the travel writing stuff, and I got a blog on there, and any upcoming, you know, media stuff I do for that. And then I've got a coaching site through RMAX, which is www.RMAXstaff.com, so RMAXstaff.com/Murdock, and that's where I usually keep updated all my coaching stuff. And then, you know, any ebooks or any of that sort of thing I'm offering. So yeah, that's the best contact spots.
Okay. And do you have any future plans?
Police blotters. You could follow the police blotters of any number of third world countries. I probably turn up there regularly as well, or the intelligence reports of some of these places. Any dictatorship,
okay.
I'm likely to be on their files. So look there too.
Good to know. Do you have any future plans you'd like to share with the listeners?
Project type stuff or upcoming?
I know you have the recent Bodyweight Exercise Revolution. I didn't know if you were going to come out with anything similar that people who are interested in CST might be wanting to hear about.
Oh, yeah, geez, there's a lot in the pipes for the rest of this year. I mean, I'm doing a lot of seminars upcoming. Brazil, I think Coach Sonnen and I are going to Brazil in about a month to train the federal police and some others. And I got a thing in Nova Scotia coming up in a couple of weeks. That's in Eastern Canada. There's the big CST instructor, Cert in Bellingham, the usual one. You'll be there for that one, I guess, huh?
Yes, I will be.
I'm looking forward to that. And then I'm doing a cert in UK, in London, and a taxes certification in Germany. So that's all in the next couple months. And then product-wise, Adam Steer and I are working on right now on a fat loss ebook. So from the Bodyweight Exercise Revolution series that you mentioned, one of the programs that people seem to like the most and to jump on the most was the fat loss program. I mean, it's something universal that we all seem to be concerned about. So we decided to push that one a little deeper and make a 3-month plan. So three nested training cycles that build on each other and to really fuel up that fat burning furnace. So we're quite excited about that one. And then of course that'll be released by the end of the summer, I hope. And what else? That Bodyweight Exercise Revolution was part one of a series we were doing on the 4x7 training protocol. So we got volume 2 coming up, which will be club bell circuits primarily, but they'll explore different training protocols as well within 4x7. So things like Tabatas and density cycles and all this stuff. That's I'm quite excited about that one, actually. I love club bell training, so this is it's going to be good. And I'm working on some stuff with this vocal coach in the States called Jamie Vendera, so working on some portable fitness programs for his rock star guys that they can do on the road, so stuff for guys on tour, but also the next thing I think will be some sort of yoga-based thing to release some of the typical overcompensations that all these musicians seem to suffer from. So we're put together something for their needs. So that's what I got going on in the CST front. On the writing front, there's lots of stuff too, of course. I think something in Dubai is on the horizon for this fall. Working on an expedition to Oman. So to get way into the interior of Oman at the bottom of the Arabian Peninsula, that's been working on that for a couple of years now. Taking a personal trip to Japan in the fall. Probably do some writing on that. And in terms of stuff, I got a magazine feature out right now, actually the main feature in Outpost magazine on a trip to Ireland I did last year. That's a nice little family piece exploring the place my grandparents came from, sort of thing. And the issue after that, I have the main feature again on a trip to Egypt. So that's working on that actually today. And other than that, I'm shopping a book around actually on Central America, kind of my life's work to date that I've worked on for about 7 years. So that's finally done and looking for a home. I've got to decide between literary agents to represent it. And once that's off, then working on another book and some more big expedition plans. So that's all for this year, I guess.
Busy guy. Definitely.
Yeah, I don't know about next year yet, but we'll see. We'll see if I live through all this first.
I'm sure it's always a chance. All right, well, one more question, and you don't have to answer if you don't want to, but do you have any stories that you think represent the travel writer that you'd like to share before we go? Maybe just one last story.
What kind of thing are you looking for? I got piles.
I don't know.
Not a piles. Day in piles the... is actually a...
Just a day in the life of a travel writer who is in the middle of the zone. I know it's different for every time, but...
On the road or at home? At home, it's quite boring. I mean, it's a really...
I don't want to hear about you at home. I want to hear about on the road.
I don't go out of the house for weeks at a time. People think I'm that guy, you know. You ever hear the Tom Waits thing? What's he building in there? I'm that guy. Everybody, my arm reaches out the door to get the mail. Oh, yeah. What the hell is he building in there? That's a very strange occupation. But you know, on the road, it depends on the kind of assignment. Like, magazine trips are pretty focused, and we work really long hours. We actually do work. I mean, it is taxing on your liver. I mean, you can write up your notes in a bar someplace if you want to while sipping something nice, but it's a lot of work. I mean, the magazine stuff, there's pressure to produce some kind of cool story because somebody else has just paid for all of this stuff. But I like the more open-ended stuff where I can go off on my own. Like I did a really cool trip in Jordan a couple of years ago. That's one of my favorites, I think, where I can kind of pick my own stories, and whatever I'm interested in doing, they'll help me set something up usually. So I was interested in improving my camel skills. I mean, I'd done some camel stuff in the far west of China before, but I wanted to learn how to handle them on my own so I can do a big thing in the Sahara by myself at some point. So we hooked up with some Bedouin tribesmen in Wadi Rum, the place where it's the place where they shot the film Lawrence of Arabia. So it's quite a beautiful place, and we spent about a week or so, myself and a photographer and one Bedouin guy, just riding off into the distance there and sleeping on the ground, you know, under the stars. It was quite nice. We got really far out, like towards the Saudi border kind of thing, places where just nobody goes. So I like places like that. The desert's a place of crazy philosophies, you know, and all the world's aesthetics usually disappeared into the desert at some point to get a handle on things and to think, and that's that kind of landscape really does it for me, I think. Not so partial to jungle because of the giant bugs. I don't do well with that usually.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
The giant bugs are horrific. No, God, it's god awful. There's some terrible giant, very frightening bugs in the world. I mean, I've been menaced by some big ones. Actually, yeah, look, there's a story for you. that it's not all it's cracked up to be. People think we stay in 5-star hotels and all this stuff, that, but very, very rarely. But I was staying in Rangoon, the capital of Burma, with my girlfriend joined me on one of these trips. It wasn't for the magazine. I was on my own, and the room that I had found was quite a good value, but it was run by these Indian traders, and it was above some kind of machine shop or something. Like, there wasn't even really any sign. I don't know how I found the place. You had to go through some kind of machine shop to get to the hotel, but the room was okay. And one of the problems was that the wall didn't go all the way to the floor or the ceiling. There was a gap below it, and there was no kind of mosquito netting, so you're just plagued by mosquitoes all night long, and it's malarial there, of course, so it's you don't know what you're getting bit by. And when the only pills you have were bought in some pharmacy in Vietnam, they're probably not really very good. But everything seemed to be working out quite fine until I was laying there reading, you know, half stupefied by the mosquito coil that we're trying to keep the pests away with. And I looked down, and there was kind of a dingy shower room attached to the room that we were staying in. And from beneath the door crawled this just god-awful enormous cockroach, like almost the size of my hand. So I picked up a hiking boot, and I fought this beast. And I think I had to hit it 4 or 5 good blows to finally kill it. And, of course, it makes a horrible noise when you do that. And then another one came out. I think I fought off about 3 of these things. My girlfriend was horrified, of course. And I finally I ripped this curtain down off the wall and shoved it in the gap underneath the door to prevent any more from coming through so we could sleep, which seemed to me a good solution. I got a good night's sleep. And when I woke up in the morning, though, and I opened the door to go into the washroom, I found half my bar of soap was missing. So during the night while we were sleeping, a rat ate half my soap.
Oh, man.
And I had to carve off that. I didn't say anything. You know, I just carved off that little piece with all the teeth marks and then showered. And we were forced to move the next day. I was fine with the place, but she refused to stay there another night. So that's the kind of accommodations I generally find.
Fantastic. Well, if there's any future travel writers on the recording, and they're really going to be encouraged about the potentials this career affords.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, and did I mention the pay is god awful as well? You'll be paid hardly anything for your efforts, so it's you can't really do it for the money. You better just enjoy it.
Absolutely.
But it's the kind of job it's like coaching too. I mean, well, you can do much better at coaching, but both things in have in common that it's the work itself that's the most rewarding, I think.
Right. And that's getting back to, you know, learning to realize how much less we can actually live with, you know. I'm totally with you on that.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, it's if what you're doing doesn't fulfill you in itself, like, and that's why CST is a path of mastery. I mean, that deepening development of your abilities and of your abilities, not just as a coach, but as an athlete and as a person yourself, that constant expanding of your frontiers, that's really what it's all about. And if you're not happy with that, if you're looking for something else, then it's probably not for you. That's why I really like these working with the faculty guys. I mean, each of them, those guys have accomplished so much, but none of them is ever content to sit back and rest on that. They're always looking for the next piece, and it's a great group of people to work with.
Awesome. All right, well, that wraps up all the questions I have. It was a real pleasure interviewing you, Ryan, and I'd love to get you on again sometime.
Yeah, hey, anytime you want to put up with my vague, incoherent ramblings, then sure, you're welcome. That's the thing.
Well,
I've
for everyone.
I've spent too much time alone, so you can expect an earful when you call me.
that's fine with me. All right, well, I guess that wraps things up.